Hi, welcome to GDC. Good morning. This is me turning off my cell phone. Everyone else should do the same. Hey, wow, this is my title slide. All right, let's get started. So, what is my lecture about? As it shows back here on the title slide, it's called My Adventures with Inverse Kinematics. And basically, over the past year, I've been writing this game. It's a rock climbing game. So you directly control a character who's, he's rock climbing. And this lecture is about the path I took while trying to solve some problems with the animation with this game. And I was trying to solve those problems with inverse kinematics for reasons that will become clear soon. And so I'm going to talk about the directions I went, mistakes I made, and maybe you can help learn from some of the decisions I made, both good and bad. It also of some interest, hopefully, will be how I use mathematics to model and sometimes occasionally solve problems in doing this. Now, it's important to point out that this is a work in progress, and so it comes with all the usual caveats. So what isn't this lecture about? This lecture is not an IK tutorial or introduction. You're also not going to come out on, there's not a final title, a final slide at the end of the lecture, which has the one true IK algorithm that you'll be able to type into your computer when you get to your office. It also has nothing to do with graphics. Oftentimes, especially in the popular press, IK is confused with or conflated with techniques for actually rendering things and animating. But IK, as far as I'm concerned, is just about movement, which we're going to talk about. And so, there's, as you'll see from the screenshots and the demo I'm going to show, graphics is clearly not the focus of this talk. It's also not about my game. The rock climbing game that I'm working on is kind of motivation for talking about some of this stuff, but the techniques I'm going to talk about are generally useful. As a small plug for the Jonathan Blow's experimental gameplay workshop on Friday, I am going to actually talk about my game from a game design perspective there. John's creating a workshop where you can, where small experimental games, are a kind of forum for those to be discussed, not huge AAA products. So I encourage you to go there. Okay. Being on the GDC advisory board, we encourage everyone to have a concrete takeaway from their talk, so here's my takeaway slide. My goal with this talk is that you will come out of the room with insight onto how doing IK on the entire human body, which is what I'm trying to do, is very different from doing IK on a single arm or a single leg from the hip down. You'll also see towards the end how I've started to look at IK as just a building block, not as kind of an overhyped solution to all character animation problems. And that's kind of important, and we're going to talk about that towards the end. So, prerequisites for my talk. You have to be comfortable with math. You don't have to know a lot of math, I don't think, to follow this talk, but I am going to throw equations up and say, oh, this is how this equation models this effect or this situation. And so being comfortable with math and picking things up quickly and not turning off when you see math is an important part. It's also probably best if you've implemented an IK system yourself, just a simple IK system where you've done some sort of like, oh, let me pick up the water bottle with the arm, or let me place the foot on the hill kind of thing. You'll be probably get more of the talk if you've done that. Okay. A little about the structure of the talk. As you can see with my amazing PowerPoint alpha blending technology, I've shown you a snippet out of the middle of a stream of the talk structure, which is basically saying I'm going to have a problem statement. So we'll talk about a specific problem and some discussion about that problem. Then I'm going to go on to some related theory about the problem. Then I'm going to talk about the attempted solution to that problem. And then, hey, I'm going to have problems with that solution. And then I'm going to go on and re-loop back. As it says at the top, The problem space that I'm talking about is not totally linear. I can't just go from solution to problem to theory to solution to problem to theory. So I'm going to have to backtrack a couple times, and I'll point out where that's happening. But usually we're going to go down a path and kind of come back up and then go down another path, I'm trying to deal with all the problems we come across in turn. So let's get started. Our first problem is basically how to move a guy with the mouse. This is kind of the overall problem statement that I started on basically last year at this time. I wanted to make a rock climbing game where you had direct control over the limbs of the character. I wanted it, obviously, to be, since it's a game, it wanted to be at interactive frame rates. And a kind of important thing for me is that I did not want to use physics for this to start with. I'd kind of been working on some, like, high-end physics stuff for a number of years, and I kind of wanted to get away from that and take a break and just do some purely animation-based stuff. Sadly, physics came back into my life again. Well, not sadly, I love physics, but... So let me just give you a quick demo of the kind of thing I'm talking about. Hey, I can drag this guy around, and he reacts kind of like a human. Now, there's problems, which, of course, we're going to talk about. But this is the idea. Like, it's a direct control over a human body. So this gives you some idea of what we're talking about here. Okay? All right. So some theory associated with this problem. I'm going to talk about, just to get us all on the same page at the beginning, I'm going to talk about the differences between forward kinematics and inverse kinematics and kind of define those terms. So if you see, I hate not being able to point at something on the slides, but, okay, this is really lame, but can you see my mouse cursor? You can see in this little 2D arm we've got here up on the side, I've got a two-link arm in 2D. So I've got an end effector position P, which is just the X and Y coordinates of the end effector of the thing. The root of the arm here at the bottom is fixed in world space. And I've got two degrees of freedom, which I'm going to talk more about in a little bit, theta 1 and theta 2, which are the joint angles of this arm. So this is all pretty standard, right? I stuff both of those into vectors, Q and P, and from that, I can state two problems. I can say the forward kinematics problem, which says F of Q equals P. It says where is the end effector given a known state Q of the joint angles? So that's forward kinematics. So if you look on the diagram here that I'm pointing at that you can't see because it's on my laptop instead of up there, but I'm not that tall, you get, if I have G, the goal point for P, and I want to get P to line up with G, the forward kinematics problem makes this a little difficult. Well, because all I have is P as an output, so I can, play with the joint angles a little bit, see how P moves, move it a little closer, et cetera. So the inverse kinematics problem was kind of created to solve this. Here I want to invert F to give me Q from a known point I want to reach. So I'd shove G into the inverse of P, or F, and I get out Q. That this says, hey, in order to make P line up with G on that little diagram, the red dot, what is the Q that I need to make that happen? That's the inverse kinematics problem. In general, P, or our goal, our end effector position, is in Euclidean space. It's in 2D, XY space in this slide. It might have angles in it as well. It might say, hey, I want to also keep track of the orientation of the end effector, right? My hand has multiple orientations, even though it's at the same point. And Q is kind of, in the examples we're talking about, abstract, is just joint angles. You can have linear degrees of freedom in there as well. So I keep saying degrees of freedom, and what does that mean? A degree of freedom is an incredibly important concept in mathematics. It's way more useful than just in physics or in kinematics and animation. And you find it everywhere, and it's really important to understand it. The degree of freedom of a system is kind of soundbitey way is the ways in which that system can change. And you really, to really understand a system, you have to find out what its degrees of freedom are. So in the example of our 2D arm, the joint angles are the degrees of freedom of the system. There are two degrees of freedom in this system. The length of the segments is not changeable in this example. If they were, that would add more degrees of freedom because I would be able to reach more and more different places. So theta 1 and theta 2 in this example are the degrees of freedom. And they allow me to control the end effector position in the entire workspace of this manipulator. So to really understand a system, I can say, oh, this is a 2-degree of freedom system. And that tells me something about the system. To control a system, I control and constrain the degrees of freedom. So by plugging in new values into theta 1 and theta 2, I can actually control the system. So the examples include the physical system we're talking about here, which is just this two-link arm, but also something like a polynomial. It's an abstract quadratic equation. Everyone knows the whole ax squared plus bx plus c formulation for a quadratic equation, that formulation actually explicitly shows the 3 degrees of freedom in a quadratic equation, A, B, and C. By modifying A, B, and C, I can reach all possible quadratic equations. Those are 3 degrees of freedom of that system. And then they're very similar in the sense to the way this works. Degrees of freedom are the handles on which you can move a system, whether it's physics or not. So to restate the task of IK, we can say it's to invert the forward kinematics equations, but another way to say it is that the fundamental task of inverse kinematics is to control degrees of freedom of a system to attain a specific goal. In this case, although I don't draw it on here, if I have this point G, I control the degrees of freedom so that I line up the end effector, which is the end result of the equation F, with G. So, our first solution is how to control a guy with the mouse. Well, let's try some analytical IK. I have this P equals F of Q, and I want to shove in P and get out Q, so I need to invert F. So this is actually relatively easy for the 2D arm that we're talking about here. You get some inverse trig, some vector algebra, and off you go. The problem is it gets really complicated to analytically invert the forward kinematics equations as your n increases. So that leads us from this solution to our next problem, which is analytical IK can't actually handle a human being. So why is that? Well, a human has a lot of degrees of freedom. I mean, human beings, like actual flesh and blood human beings, have hundreds of degrees of freedom. I mean, made even more complicated by the fact that you're a deformable object, so you've got all these other degrees of freedom that aren't just related to your joint angles. But, so the example of the character in that little, like, demo app I was showing you, the climbing game, that character has 13 degrees of freedom, which is still far more than a 2D degree of freedom arm. Anyone who's actually written out the 2 or the 3D, analytical IK, they've inverted F themselves, knows that it's hard enough with 2 or 3 degrees of freedom and it gets completely out of control. There are equations, closed form equations for 6 degrees of freedom, but you pretty much give it up above that. Even in this example right here, which I can't point to, on the corner there, this three-link arm has more degrees of freedom than it needs to actually reach the goal. There's a relationship, which we'll talk about more in a minute, that from the degrees of freedom of a system to the number of ways it can change the output. And in this case, I'm only tracking P, the XY position of the end effector, but I have 3 input degrees of freedom in this new system. I've got theta 1, theta 2, and theta 3. What that means is, you can actually just visualize it in this little diagram. I could easily change theta 3 to bring P to G. But then I've still got a degree of freedom left. P being a 2D constraint by putting P at G, I still have 1 degree of freedom left. So that means I have an infinite number of positions the rest of the arm can be in, even if P is coincident with G. So let's kind of get down into the theory here a little bit. And so what I'm saying is that inverting the forward kinematics equations requires some characteristics on the actual equations you're doing. So what are some of those characteristics? Well, first, let's define the system. So P equals F of Q, which is I shove in the joint angles and I get out the end effector position, is a set of nonlinear equations. It's a set because it's a vector. P is a vector, it's a 2D vector, and Q is a vector, in this case, a 3D vector. It's nonlinear because if you ever write out the, like, equations to take these joint angles and convert them into linear space where P is, you have a bunch of sines and cosines and squares on the lengths and things like that in there. The sad truth is that if you have nonlinear equations, and especially sets of nonlinear equations, you're basically hosed as far as, in general, computing closed-form solutions. So we lucked out in 2D that we could invert this equation, but it's just not going to happen very often there. So what happens is you end up having to iterate numerically. It's not that you can't solve it. There's a difference in math between whether you can solve a system and whether you can write a closed-form solution to a system. You can't write a closed-form solution in the general case, but you can always solve it if you meet certain characteristics. One of those characteristics is that the system must be square. And by square, I mean the input degrees of freedom, Q, and the output degrees of freedom, P, the domain and range, have the same dimension. In this case, on the arm here, that's actually not the case. I have 3 degrees of freedom of the system and only 2 degrees of freedom I'm tracking. So in order to solve this system uniquely, because to invert an equation, it means you have to make a new function which is unique, I would need to make another constraint. So if I had an angular constraint on P here, meaning what angle it comes into the goal at, then I would have three input-output degrees of freedom, XP equals XY and you know, phi. And I have three input degrees of freedom, and it's possible that I could invert that system. Possibly analytically, because it's such a simple system, but in the general case, also numerically. In the case that I've actually got here, where I've only got 2 degrees of freedom, P equals X and Y, with a 3 degree of freedom manipulator, I've got an under-constrained system. Also called, in the inverse kinematics literature, as a redundant manipulator. What the redundancy here is the fact that I can have P at a goal and still be able to move the arm with a single degree of freedom. Now, when I've actually attained the goal, it does not mean that P of X and Y maps directly to theta 1 and theta 2, and theta, you know, so theta 3 is our degree of freedom that's left over when you subtract out the constraints. It's going to be some nonlinear relationship between the two, but the point is there is one degree of freedom I can find, possibly a relationship between theta 1, theta 2, and theta 3, that allows me to manipulate, that allows me to reach all of those infinite positions in between. So an example is, hey, if I want to touch the end of this microphone as a human being with a lot of degrees of freedom, this is just one solution. Hey, I'm still touching exactly the right place, but I'm moving all over the place. These are degrees of freedom that are redundant in humans. The reason you can actually get most of your work done is because you have a lot of redundant degrees of freedom that you can use and spend in other ways, which we'll talk more about later. So we've got this system, P equals F of Q, and we want to solve it. Sometimes it's exactly square, sometimes it's over-constrained, sometimes it's under-constrained, but the case is we want to be able to get joint angles out for our P. In general, there's a lot of literature for solving this problem. Well, there's a lot of literature for solving this problem in general. But when you happen to be, when your F that you're trying to invert is a kinematics equation, there's an algorithm called cyclic coordinate descent that is highly useful for solving this. It's an iterative, like, as we said, it kind of has to be an iterative algorithm if it's going to solve the general problem. It's an iterative and recursive algorithm that works in position space, meaning it directly adjusts the position of the arm, the angles and the end effector position. It's iterative and recursive in the sense that you start at the root, you go all the way out to the end effector, and then you come back solving each joint independently. How can I get this joint, how can I move this joint angle to take my end effector closer to G? So it's kind of this local optimization phase, and it kind of ripples back across the thing. It's really fast, it's really easy to implement, and it's very robust. It doesn't blow up. It sometimes is slow to converge, but most of the time it works really well, especially for game graphics applications. I'm not going to talk in detail about the actual implementation of the algorithm because there's a lot of literature out there on it. But two things that I do, there's a couple of different decisions you have to make when you're doing it, and two things that I do are, one, I start from the last position. So there's this thing, so it's an iterative algorithm. All numerical iterative algorithms in math have this property that you have to give them an initial condition to start with. Now, that initial condition could just be all zeros in the joint angles. But if you're close already, meaning, say, G is attached to the mouse in this diagram, if you're close and G is just moving a little bit, maybe your current guess is actually your previous frame's joint angles are pretty good, approximation, and it might converge faster there. There's a couple of things there. One, that assumption that it might converge faster might be wrong. Sometimes CCD converges slower if you start nearer to the solution, which is a little odd. There's another thing that's interesting is this concept of path independence. If I take, say I have my goal, this G here, and I'm going to move it from point A to point B along a certain path. Let's say I start with point A satisfied, so P equals G at A, and then I move G to B through one path, path number one. If I do the exact same thing through path number two, so G goes from A to B through path number two, starting with the previous frame's, starting from the previous frame's position is not going to provide path independence. You might get a different configuration at B than you would for the two different paths, which is totally reasonable. I mean, for an under-constrained system, I can grab this microphone this way, or I can grab this microphone this way. And if I was starting low, I might have come up this way, but if I was starting high or went high, I might have gone this way. It's not a bad thing. You're still going to get a solution to the system, but with an under-constrained system, you've got these other redundant degrees of freedom, which are going to get spent while it solves it. So it's something to think about. Another detail is that I draw, so it's an iterative algorithm in the sense that you can go out the arm and then come back doing this inner iteration at every step. You adjust all of your joint angles. You get the desired angle. You set the theta to that. And then you get back to the root, the base, and you might not have solved the problem. And so it goes out again. It's an iterative algorithm. It's not a finite closed-form algorithm. The literature usually just says, hey, you know, you iterate until you get some convergence quality, and then you draw. And then you call that a solution, and then you draw. Well, I just draw every outside iteration. So the thing is moving through space, and it looks kind of like animation. If I'm moving G, it's going to slowly converge to G, if we're assuming the algorithm works at all. It looks like animation, but it's not actually animation, even though it looks like enough like it that I bother to draw it. Because it's really just trying to find a solution. It's not saying it's not animation in the sense that, like, there was a force that caused the arm to move that way or anything like that. It's like, this is just an artifact of the way the CCD algorithm solves the system, and since it is converging P to G, hey, it looks like P is moving towards G. It's important to understand the difference between those two, though. Okay. But here's a problem with CCD. It only really handles, as it's initially defined, serial chains, meaning a snake. You and I are not serial chains, unless you've had a number of appendages removed. So we need multiple goals. We need multiple branching points. In our diagram here, I've enhanced my amazing PowerPoint art to show now I have P1 and P2, which have goals G1 and G2. So now I've got a lot more angles. So I see I just stack them all together. So I still have a nonlinear. I still have f, P equals f of q. It's a nonlinear set of nonlinear equations. But now P is a stack of two 2D coordinates. It's x1 y1 x2 y2. Q is theta 1 through 5. And you can see that in the diagram. The two branches after the first branching point are pretty independent. They can move arbitrarily. But once you get down to theta 1, they're both dependent on theta 1's angle, which means there's a coupling there once you get down to theta 1, meaning theta 1, the angle, the root angle, base angle, determines where P1 and P2 can be, whereas, say, the angle theta 5 does not affect the position of P1, if you can see in the diagram. So you get this coupling between goals that makes things a little more complicated. So you can easily envision a situation where I've got a system that's solvable if I only have one of the two goals. So imagine you drag the two G's to either side of the PowerPoint slide. If I only turned on one of those goals and I'll just let the other branch just drift, I can attain goal 1. If I turn on goal 2, I could attain that goal. But if I could turn on both at the same time, I want my guy to grab two places. All of a sudden, there's this constraint on theta 1 that says, oh, I got to please all the people all the time, and it's not necessarily possible to solve that together. So the real problem with doing multiple branch stuff is not how you actually formulate it, because if everybody's able to be satisfied, then CCD will find the solution. It's how do you distribute the angle or the desired angle error. Meaning, CCD comes back from P1, and it says, oh, well, this P1 iteration wants theta 1 to be, you know, whatever, alpha. And it comes back from P2, and it says, I want theta 1, you know, so theta 1 is 0 for P1, and P2 comes back, and I want it to be pi. Meaning, I want it to be totally slammed over here for one of them, and totally slammed over here for the other. So what do? Well, the really simple solution is to average the desired angles at every branching point. Or the branch point parents, because it's really theta 1, not theta 2 and 4 that have this conflict. So in this example, hey, I average between the two goals that the different branches want for theta 1, and I kind of split the difference between them. Which works pretty well, except for you get this drift when it cannot satisfy all of the goals. So you can see that in the demo. If I drag this guy over like this, you can see the other hand moving away. It's moving away. So the hand I'm dragging is moving away from the mouse, the goal, but the other hand is also moving away from the hold, which is kind of undesirable. The average can't satisfy all the goals. I mean, there's no algorithm that can satisfy all the goals. You might just be giving it incompatible goals. But the average can't even prioritize them, because what I want to do is I want to say, oh, I want... If the climber's hands are on the wall, I want to drag one of the hands or feet, and if that's not exactly tracking the mouse, that's okay, because it's kind of got an interactive feedback loop and the person is like trying to position it and they'll just think it's kind of straining. But I want the other one to stay put on the hold, because that's where he's actually attached to the wall. So what I really want is a rigid constraint at the end effector. I want this to just stay locked there. The problem is that that forms a closed loop, and closed loops are hard. If you look at this simplified little guy here, on the left-hand side, I have, say, an end effector that I want to stay at the red dot. And on the right-hand side, I have a potential mouse movement that would obviously, if I'm going to please all the people all the time, is going to pull me away from both. I'm not going to be able to meet the mouse movement and keep my guy on the end effector. So what is theta to do? So first off, why this is a problem for a closed loop. The closed loop is if the red dot on the left-hand side was rigidly defined there, I've got the root down by the theta symbol on the floor there, and it goes up to a movable joint and then over to an immovable joint, a thing that's fixed again. I mean, it might rotate, but it's going to be fixed in position space. So if you think about it, I've got this loop through the ground, up through my manipulator, and then back through the ground. It's not a hierarchy anymore in an important sense. This closed loop means that the behavior of my system is not local anymore. I can, in an open loop system, I can adjust one thing and be pretty confident that any work I do here is not going to completely screw me up downstream. Because I know, because it's open loop, that I don't connect back to myself. In a closed loop system like a necklace, if I pull here to correct an error, it might create more of an error somewhere else. So I've got to solve it completely simultaneously, which makes it much harder. So my cheesy solution to this was to use a technique called Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization to try and correct for the drift problem in the UI. So let's talk about what Gram-Schmidt is really quick. It's just a linear algebra term. If you look at the vector diagram on the left, I've got vectors A and B, and I want to say, the thing I want Gram-Schmidt to do for me is remove all of the A direction from B, which means, if you think about what that means, I'll have a new vector C, which is B with none of the A. It'll be totally perpendicular, and what it means in linear algebra to have no component of another vector in there is to be perpendicular. So you can see that what Gram-Schmidt did when it produced a C for me is it removed all of A from B, and I get this perpendicular to A. That is still the most B I can be while being perpendicular to A. So how do I use this in my UI? What I do is, hey, I've got this thing on the left, which says, I'm trying to reach this goal, but I have a little error building up there. And that error is in 2D. It's a vector. That vector tells me what direction the thing is pulling away from the hold. I take that direction, and I've got the potential mouse movement that the user wants to drag with, and I Gram-Schmidt away that direction from the mouse movement. So all of a sudden, I can't drag my mouse in the direction that the error is saying is increasing. In this example right here, you can see this would prevent the error in this little local example. I can't drag sideways. I can drag up and down, because if you see the delta between the dot on the goal on the left-hand side and the end effector position is this little horizontal vector, I mean, within the accuracy of PowerPoint. So I can still move my thing up and down, which seems like compatible intuitively with this. The problem with the solution is that that simplified Gram-Schmidt, where I directly take the error from an end effector, the error vector from an end effector, and map that onto the mouse cursor, is going to choose the wrong direction some of the time. And you can see that in this situation, in the same situation where if I start pulling down on the mouse cursor, and so instead of pulling sideways, I'm going to start pulling down, that arm is going to eventually start to rotate as I get far enough away from the perpendicular there, and that rotation is going to have the exact same effect on the end effector that I'm trying to stay rigidly locked. It's still going to have a horizontal angle, because as that thing rotates, it's instantaneously pulling it to the left, to the right. But I'm pulling down with the mouse, and so that Gram-Schmidt's not going to do anything. So what you really want to do here is use what's called the Jacobian of the system, to figure out the mapping between the direction the error is growing and the direction that I'm moving the mouse. So you can write an equation, a set of equations, a matrix really, that says instantaneously a mouse movement in this direction would map to an end effector movement in this other direction. And so you can gram, and then you kind of seen through the lens of the Jacobian, you can just do the generic Gram-Schmidt thing that I talked about, and boom, you Gram-Schmidt off the error in the direction that instantaneously is the one that's going to increase your error at the end effector. So I'm going to move on to another problem here, and that is that human beings are not rooted trees. All the examples we've given before have this, like, ground plane with a thing stuck in it and then, like, you know, angles coming off of that. But if you look at this little guy that I've drawn here, where's the root? Like, I want to be able to, as I showed you in the little demo, I want to be able to drag this guy. I want to be able to click on any end effector and drag him or the torso. So which one of them is a root? Well, the fact is there is no persistent root in a rock climber. Like, you can move, I mean, the whole point of climbing up is you're obviously not rooted to the ground in any way. And this is true of a walking person as well. As I walk across the stage, at any given moment I might have one foot planted, but hey, and a second later it's gonna not be it's not gonna be the root anymore. So I don't have this persistent root, fixed root that I can hard code into my, you know, system. But the problem is CCD has to start at a fixed root. So what do you do? So the thing that comes to mind is, oh, why don't I just resort my guy so that I have a different root? Because, hey, if you think about it, let's say I had modeled my guy with the left foot as the root. Well, there's not that much difference between modeling the guy with the right foot as the root. You know, the movement is kind of going to be this symmetric thing, or at least it's going to be this mirror image. So you think about, hey, why don't I figure out a way of just converting on the fly between which end effector is the root. Now, with a walking guy, all you need to do is say, hey, I want it to be left foot, right foot, or left, whatever. With a climbing guy, you need to be able to send the root to other places because I need to be able to move my feet, both feet as well, or both feet come off when I'm hanging there or something like that. But this is really not a mathematical problem. It's really just a code problem. It's a data structure problem. I've got this data structure in memory which has the tree, the root of the tree, the base of the tree, and then all of the joints coming off of it. Are all of the links coming off of it with nodes and then link and then node. So to actually invert that tree is just a data structure problem. I have to just grind through and, like, figure out the thing. The only math there is making sure that the relative angles get reflected and inverted around the angle, around the inversion points such that the guy doesn't move when you see, you know, when you run the code that inverts his tree. It obviously should look like the same guy. Now, and also joint limits, any joint limits need to be recomputed in the new relative space. The one thing that's kind of a little bit strange is that the behavior is going to change slightly, because CCD, by my short description of the algorithm, tends to favor, because it starts on the outward, the outbound links, CCD is going to tend to move those links first. So if CCD completely meets the CCD meets the goal before it gets down to the root, it's not going to move the root at all. It's not going to move the base angle at all, right? Because it doesn't have any error left to try and compensate for. Which means that if I invert from left foot to right foot, the behavior of my system will be slightly different. Now that might be okay because hey, my walk is asymmetric as well. But you can see when the left leg, so if you can see the difference if you're moving in hand between if the left or the right foot is the root, because that one moves in a different way because it's not because it is more outbound. But if this is a solution and it works fine, you just have to type it in. You have to figure out what your data structure is and you have to write the code to actually invert the data structure. I'm writing this game in this wacky language called Objective Camel, which I talked about last year in my lecture. And it's actually pretty good at this kind of, like, data structure manipulation, so it was not that bad. One thing I didn't mention is that I want to be able to drag the torso of the guy. So how do you do this? Well, CCD doesn't allow you. I mean, CCD has the end effector positions that it'll try and attain goals for. There's no way to say in CCD, oh, I want, you know, I've got the snake arm and I want this middle guy to be somewhere, okay? So what do I do for moving the torso around where it's not obviously rooted? Well, what I do is I just take some, now that I've got this tree inversion code, I can make any joint the root, which makes all the other joints, all the other end effectors, or all the previous root and end effector. I can just make the internal torso node the root, and then I just attach that rigidly to the mouse. That way, all of the end effectors are CCDing to their goal. So you can see that in the demo. If I move, so right now, I don't know if you can see, can you see that this is black and this is blue here? Is that at all visible? Okay, so the black dot is the root. So, hey, if I click here, I'm not on the root, and like you can see that it's moving my knee first, and it like looks fine. If I click here, what's it going to do? And well, up here is the same thing, right? It's not the root; it's all just a multi-link, tree. If I move here, boom, it switches the root to the other leg behind the scenes, right? And you can see that this leg moves much more readily than it did when it was the root. The issue comes when I want to move the torso because I want to adjust him and have him crouch. Well, what I do is I just make all, as soon as I click down, I make all of the end effectors instead of the root. So I flip the root to wherever the mouse cursor is, and then I translate that directly and then CCD out the rest of the system to the current end effectors. So what does this mean? Well, in that drift thing that I was talking about earlier with the Gram-Schmidt, which is not turned on in this, hey, I can pull, and I come up way from the other hand, but you can notice that the root leg doesn't ever come away. It's totally rigid. But when I'm actually translating the root, hey, if I want to pull far enough, I can just drag the guy away, right? Because it's just doing the CCD to the actual end effectors. So translating the root is kind of a hack. It's kind of like an asymmetry in the system. It works pretty well as long as you don't let it go very far away. You can obviously do the Jacobian or the Gram-Schmidt thing here. Hey, I can jot off of the mouse every way, which direction, which is going to cause error in the CCD. But it is kind of a hack. Okay. Let's back up and go to a slightly different path in our tree, which is joint limits. Most of us cannot bend our elbow backwards. So adding joint limits here, but where CCD has no concept of, you know, an IK system, unless you tell it about a joint limit, doesn't have any concept of, like, not allowing you to bend your elbow backwards. So by telling the IK system about that we don't want, that elbows do stop here, the hope is that we'll lend some believability and intuition to the motion. If you drag the guy here, you can see it shouldn't invert the arm, and in fact it doesn't, because hey, there's actually a joint limit there, which you can see there. And it won't let this thing go beyond that, which is kind of the equivalent of this little diagram. I've got this arc that I want to allow movement within. So what is a joint limit in theory? A joint limit in theory is an inequality constraint on one of the degrees of freedom. In the diagram I have theta, and I have theta min and theta max, and theta has to be between those two. The very first thing that happens is you abandon all, I mean, we've already abandoned it in a lot of ways, but all hope of an analytical solution is basically out the window at this point, because you've started changing the configuration space. You've got this degree of freedom in this space, in the configuration space, where the degrees of freedom live. So they're directions, they're axes in this configuration space. This inequality is basically a plane, axis line plane in configuration space. So if you think of the configuration space of this joint, this 1D joint, it's a line, right? Well, it's actually a circle because it can come around 360 degrees. But locally, it's a line. I can move back and forth. It's a scalar, theta. I can just jack it back and forth. What does theta min and theta max do to that? It chops off areas on that line that I can't get out of. So now I'm stuck on this line between these two points. It adds discontinuities and the configuration space changes. But CCD makes this kind of joint limit really easy to make, really easy to implement. Because in your inward iteration with CCD, you just clamp to the min-max joint angles, and CCD kind of deals. So CCD, the CCD algorithm comes back and says, oh, I want, I have a new desired angle for this joint. I'm not reaching my goal, and so this rotation of this joint would help me reach my goal a little bit better. So I have this desired angle. And then you take that desired angle, and you clamp that to your joint limits, and hey, you just don't let it move beyond that. And then what CCD says is, oh, I didn't quite make it to my limit, let me, I'm gonna recurse back, back up the tree at one more step, And hey, that guy compensates a little bit more than he would have if there was no joint angle. So it seems like it's doing this compensation thing really nicely. The problem is, the issue is, that CCD doesn't really know there's a joint limit there. The algorithm is just blindly going along trying to locally optimize at every stage to bring the joint, the end effector goal to the goal, the end effector to the goal. So even though it compensates, it moves like it understands the joint angles, it doesn't actually know about them. So you can see this. So I've got my guy here. And hey, I got to a joint angle on this limb, but it's still working because the shoulder is taking advantage of is taking up the slack. But did you see what just happened there? It's got this non-intuitive motion where it starts to stand up. Why does it do that? It does that because it doesn't understand that there's a joint limit on the knee there. It says, oh, well, you know, so the root is down here. And this is, so if you think about it, this is a serial, this is a chain coming up through here and out the arm, right? I start to drag this down, and at every step, CCD is coming back up each joint and trying to angle directly towards that, not knowing there's a joint limit at the knee. So the intuitive thing to meet the goal when I'm dragging down here is you just bend the knee the other way, but there's a joint limit in the way, and it doesn't know that. So what it does is it slams the knee right up against that joint limit, and the whole thing looks stupid. All right. However, that's not the only problem. So we have this parent-child joint limit thing that works pretty well in CCD. I mean, ignoring the problem I was just showing, the elbow works good. But what happens now that we allow a moving root, which we needed to do to make you be able to switch off where you're grabbing from on the guy? Let's make a little example. So this is kind of like a disembodied pelvis with two legs and a torso. And right now, the left leg is the root, right? The left foot. So he's got the little ground line there. And I've defined a joint limit that says, hey, the other leg can only move a certain angles of the left leg. What this means is, this is kind of a silly joint limit because it's saying you can't actually put your legs together, so you'd have to be like this, but it actually makes some sense for going like this. I can't actually raise my leg up all the way, but it's also not dependent on my torso angle, right? Like, I can't get my leg any higher no matter what my torso angle is. So that makes some sense. Hey, I define this joint limit between the two legs, and my left leg is the parent, my right leg is one of the end effectors, my torso is another end effector, and I've got this parent-child joint limit that as I come back on the right leg, I clamp in the CCD algorithm. Hey, so now I want to switch to the right foot as the end effector, as the root. Boom. I invert the parent-child joint limit because now the left leg is the parent, is the child of the right leg, which is now the root-based parent. So everything's still fine. I did the math to figure out what the mapping of the joint angle into the new parent-child relationship is. And I get a system that still has the same delta between the two legs, the same delta angle is still the driving factor there. But now what happens if I want to make the chest the root? Remember, this joint limit is between the two legs, the leg angles. If I make the chest the root, how do I actually define that when I've only got parent-child joint limits with this clamping thing in CCD? The truth is, the fact is I can't define this with parent-child joint limits because the parent-child limit here would say that the angle of the legs has to be dependent in some way on the angle of the torso, which I've said is already not the case. So I need a child-child joint limit between the two legs that's independent of the torso. I should be able, I mean, according to this silly model, I should be able to flip the torso around in a 360-degree circle without affecting the legs. The legs are only affected by their, are only related to the other leg's angle. Does that make sense? So the problem here is I can't, with parent-child joint limits, actually express this because all parent-child joint limits are going to be the chest, torso node relative, which is not expressing the same thing. So I can't actually flip the root to the torso with the current system. So what's the problem with child-child joint limits that makes them harder? The problem is that both angles are dependent on each other and coupled. The parent in the CCD algorithm is this fixed thing, but the children, especially at a branch point, are both moving independently. But now I've said, oh, there's a constraint between those two children. They can only have certain relative angles. What does that mean? Well, in the configuration space vision of it, I've got the joint angles that define the space. I've now got this non-axis aligned plane in configuration space. So if you think about, let's say we just have this 2D configuration space, you know, theta 1 and theta 2, and I have a parent-child joint limit on theta 1, what that means is theta 1 can go back and forth between these min and max, but theta 2 can be anything. So I can scroll up and down anywhere on this on the theta 2 axis, but theta 1 is locked between these two planes. Now, but if I have theta 1 and theta 2 are two children, and I want a relative joint angle constraint, now I've got this angled constraint through configuration space where if theta 1 is down here, then theta 2 can only be here. But if I'm up here, I can get a different value for each one. But the relative change is still the same. The relative relationship is still the same. The problem with that is now I need to simultaneously solve all the children's joint angles at this branch. Because they all depend on each other if they're constrained together with a child-child limit. So how do I go about doing that? So let's define what we mean by a good solution before we actually solve it. I claim, and I've got the 3 points there, that a good solution should always satisfy the constraints. I mean, I define the constraints to be rigid, like solid joint limits. So the joint limits constraints should always be satisfied. If it's possible to get the end effect, so basically our sub-problem here is CCD comes down with the desired angle for the two angles that is independent of the joint limit. And then I need to figure out what the actual angle I'm going to set for the two angles of the legs are based on the desired angles, and knowing that I want to keep the joint limits rigidly satisfied. But I want to have zero error in the desired angles, if possible, because that's what actually if I set the exact desired angles, then CCD is actually working exactly as planned. But if I do have to have some error, I want it to be least squares error, meaning I don't want to favor one side over the other. I want a least squares style error says, hey, distribute the error evenly over everybody. It's kind of equivalent to this averaging thing that I was doing before where I started adding these constraints in some sense. So now we've defined our solution, the criteria for a good solution well enough that we can actually write out some math from it. Because we said we want a least squares error, or an exact, if possible, and we want rigidly constrained, rigidly satisfied constraints. So you can see I've got this thing, this nonlinear least squares with linear inequalities. Here, I've got an objective function that I want to minimize, which is saying I have theta 1, which is one of my angles, and the desired angle for theta 1. This residual, which is theta 1 minus this thing, minus the desired angle, how far away am I from the desired angle 1, I square it, add that to the same thing for theta 2, and I get this least squares objective. If I minimize that, I'm saying the squared errors, by just the writing down of it this way, the squared errors will be minimized if I can minimize this equation. But I want to minimize it with respect to theta 1 minus theta 2 is in between the max and the min, which is what's saying where the relativeness happens. Theta 1 minus theta 2 is the relative angle between the two children, the two legs, and I want that to not be able to get smaller than a certain amount and not be able to get wider than a certain amount, which gives us that set of child-child joint limits. This is called a nonlinear least squares with linear inequalities problem, and there's a whole bunch of literature out there on how to solve them. Luckily, I mean, it's a numerical solution is necessary. But luckily, it's an incredibly small dimensional problem because you just need to do this at every branching point. And human beings actually don't have, you know, n-way branching points. You just have three-way, torso into legs, you know, arms into torso, that sort of thing. Depending on how you define where your degrees of freedom are in your guy. What I do is I convert this problem. So I read up on this and I said, oh, one way I could solve this is by converting it to something called a linear complementarity problem, and I use this thing called Lemke's algorithm that works pretty well. But any solution to a nonlinear least squares with linear inequalities will solve this problem, and it's a pretty small and well-conditioned problem, and this actually ends up working great. You can see this. It's a little bit hard to see. I have joint limits at the I have basically this exact joint limit situation at this at the pelvis, and what happens is I've got limits between the two legs, here's CCD wigging out because it doesn't know about the joint limits. I've got joint limits between the two legs and limits between the torso and the legs. But they all redefine themselves. You see the legs, as I drag down, the legs can't get closer together because I've got two child limits between the legs there. So it actually works really well, and it's not that actually hard to solve, and you can go read about this solution. Okay, what have we done so far? We extended CCD in a couple ways. There's the base CCD algorithm, which is a really intuitive and really easy, fast, and robust algorithm. We've extended it to handle multiple end effector goals, so I can actually have my entire body running through this inverse kinematics algorithm, so that I can set goals for everything. I can grab this thing and grab this thing at the same time while crouching. To do that, we had to dynamically change the root node, so we also figured out how to do that. And then we figured out how to do arbitrary joint limits, because we were forced at that point to do child-child joint limits, even though because we were able to move the root. We actually generalized from that, and child-child joint limits are interesting even if you can't move, if you don't decide you don't want to move the root, because you sometimes want just a limit between two children. But we were actually forced into it because we needed to be able to move the root. So we extended CCD to handle all these things, which makes it a lot more valuable for actually simulating an entire character. We still have a bunch of problems with this situation, though. Number one is this drift problem for multiple goals is still a problem. Deeper is the fact that CCD doesn't understand what a joint limit is. It doesn't really know what's going on at that level. That is an important thing that feeds into the next one, but there's also other causes for this kind of non-physical movement. CCD is not doing a physical simulation of the articulated body. It's not conserving energy or conserving anything, as far as I can tell from looking at the math. It just, here, I will give you, I'm CCD, and you give me a set of end effector goals, and I will tell you something that's a set of joint angles that satisfies that. There's no energy minimization going on there, and there's no conservation of anything. Rooted hierarchies are still inconvenient. This whole flipping thing like works out fine with the data structure, but it's not like, I mean, it's not pretty. You don't want to have to do that. And there's the open problem of how do you control the redundant degrees of freedom in your system? A lot of what makes me look like a human, as I'm about to talk about, is how I spend my redundant degrees of freedom. I can touch this microphone, but like the way I relax into it, the way I'm kind of slouching right now and holding this other thing, kind of defines humanness about my movements. I'm not a robot that takes a high energy position like this. You'd go like, why is he holding it? Why is he touching that way? So that points to this system, and this is the second part of the takeaway, which is, it's clear that even if I had an IK system that completely solved everything, which we're relatively close to, there's a couple of like little glitches and stuff, but it still would not be enough because it doesn't understand what it means to move naturally. And so what I think is going to have to happen, and this has got an open research, is that you're going to have a body knowledge subsystem. And this is just my name for it. I made it up. If there's a better name, I'd love to know about it. But it's a subsystem to manage the movement, to spend the redundant degrees of freedom. So it sees a situation. It sees me trying to touch this thing. And it knows how a human being moves. It already has a solution from the IK that tells it how to get there, but it has to relax into the human position. So an example of this would be, you wouldn't need, if you had a really good body knowledge subsystem, you wouldn't need joint limits. Because all a joint limit is a thing that lets the IK system know that you don't hyperextend your elbow. But if there's a body knowledge system and you weren't tying it down and trying to break its elbow backwards, it would just never, because a human being doesn't do a completely straight line, a completely hyperextended elbow very often, the body knowledge system would just keep your elbow away from those positions. So if it was good enough, it would keep you looking natural. You rarely see someone completely hyperextend any of their joints. It's kind of like a huge rule system. I envision it that way. Basically, a bunch of situations and reactions. Hey, if you're in this situation, you want to kind of relax this way. And hopefully you can share and layer those. But the most important thing is it allocates those redundant degrees of freedom. I've got a 13 degree of freedom guy, and I'm only sending it four constraint equations. So I've got 8 degrees of freedom on the output, which is the end effector positions for all four. There's an infinity, 13 minus 8, 5? There's an infinity. I have 5 extra degrees of freedom I can spend on making the guy like slouch on the holds correctly. And I think the body knowledge system is going to do that. There's no way the IK can know what the right thing to do there. It's just trying to actually reach. The IK's job is done once those goals are satisfied. So the IK is just a rough initial guess for what the body knowledge system, for what the body position should be. It should make it physically plausible to send in, because, hey, if you have a better guess, you're going to be able to better do this body knowledge thing. And hopefully your underlying IK makes it easy to layer conflicting goals and like cope with over-constrained systems. Like, oh, I kind of want to grab this thing, but I'm reaching for that, so I'm kind of, you know, doing the right thing. But I don't know about this yet, because I haven't implemented this. But I think that this is actually, this body knowledge concept is going to be more important than IK for actually compelling character animation, because it's the part that actually takes the robot, the IK outputs, and turns it into a human being. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that I did not talk about. There's a whole bunch of development process stuff that when you're doing mathematical software that I thought would be interesting to talk about, but I didn't have time. The concept of working on figuring out if there are lower dimensional subproblems to work on that are representative of your higher dimensional. So I've got this 13 degree of freedom thing, and if I want to graph what the joint angles are doing, it's a 13 degree of freedom. It's a 13D graph, which is not very like intuitive. But hey, if I can just do an arm at a time, I can start to see behavior because I can graph 2 degrees of freedom, or even 3 degrees of freedom as a curve through space. So using visualizations, visualizing the planes that the joint angles make, that the joint limits make, that kind of thing, using parallel development in a computer algebra system to like double check your math, that sort of thing. There's also a bunch of physics techniques I tried for solving the same problem. I re-implemented the entire system with some physics-based stuff. That I haven't been able to talk about, that I don't have time to talk about, but there's some interesting stuff there as well. Physics is just a way of allocating the redundant degrees of freedom in the system, right? You've got, if you have physics reach for this thing and grab it, and then gravity's already holding you down, hey, maybe you're closer to what the body knowledge needs, because the redundant degrees of freedom have been energy minimized through F equals MA. Things I didn't try specifically about the CCD thing that I think are interesting avenues to pursue. I think I should have done a weighted average instead of just an average on the multiple goals part where I've got the guy who's trying to satisfy both goals, because my mouse was way less important, so I should have increased the coefficient on the average, the percentage that gets averaged in from the important ones, like the hand staying rigidly to the hold. It's still not going to rigidly attach it. It's not going to form a closed loop, but it will make it less error for the Gram-Schmidt thing to have to suck up. I'm also wrong. I stated earlier that CCD must have a fixed root. That's not actually true. And I didn't really understand this until I started to understand the degree of freedom thing better. But the root is just 2 more degrees of freedom that have been constrained off by not allowing it to move in these 2D examples. So CCD can cope just as well if having a moving root, because at any node, CCD decides what is the best way to eat up the rest of the air using just this node's degrees of freedom. Well, hey, if you've got a moving base, that's got a 2 degrees of freedom that CCD can play with. So if it hasn't eaten up all the air by the time it gets to the base, it'll translate the base. Right? I mean, you have to actually implement that. But there's nothing mathematical about having a fixed base or about having a moving base. It's just another 2 degree of freedom joint that allows it to move around. So you'd get it curving. If you had a snake and a goal, it would curve towards the goal. But if it still needed to translate, it would move. And you'd get this sort of pseudo-animation thing going. But the CCD algorithm would inverse kinematics it just fine. It's not clear what it would look like. Because it would just the end effect would just be to translate the thing if there was any error left over after the first iteration, which is a little bit weird. But you can damp down. The CCD papers have a thing about how to get more natural animation by damping down. Don't allow it to move completely to the desired angle, so you have to do a couple iterations. A bunch of IK methods that I didn't try. Pseudo-inverse methods, which give you explicit control over the redundant degrees of freedom, which is interesting. I kind of went for the dynamic stuff because, hey, I would end up writing something that would to control those degrees of freedom to be relaxed in a dynamic sense anyway, so I figured that using physics there would be more interesting. There are also data-based or model-based methods, which are kind of this huge lookup table. Hey, I motion capture a billion people, and I do them. I motion capture a billion rock climbers, and I kind of make this operator that blends between them, and which basically says, oh, well, if you want the end effectors to be here, here's a set of join angles that will do that based out of this database of movements and some blending operator between them. And there are totally ad hoc methods. I never tried to write the complete, like, old school, let me hack completely the movement to see what it would look like. I tried to approach it from a relatively methodical mathematical standpoint. There's some great master's and PhD theses about this. The Bear Locker thesis, both of these are available online, and Chris Wellman's thesis, both are great overviews. I mean, they both have contributions in certain areas, but like Wellman's thesis talks in detail about CCD, and Bear Locker talks about this whole range of IK things. He does a lot of pseudo-inverse-based methods. Google Insights here, I mean, if you type inverse kinematics into Google, you get a lot of like 3D Studio Max and Maya hits. But if you start to go like, you know, redundant manipulator, you start to get a whole bunch of papers. Sightseer, if you don't know about Sightseer, it's the best papers reference website on the planet. It actually references papers based on what their references are. It's an amazing thing. And the cool thing about being the first speaker, the downside is having to get up at 9 a.m. The cool thing is that I can actually reference two other talks that are going to happen this year's GDC, which are totally applicable to this problem if you're interested. First is David Wu's, and I was stupid and didn't actually write down exactly when they were, but look on your schedule. They're not next session, I don't think, so you're at least safe for that. David Wu's talk on the cell damage physics simulator talks a lot about degrees of freedom, and his simulator is the one I used for the physics experiments that I did that I didn't have time to talk about, or his technique for simulation. Ken Perlin's talk is actually on body knowledge. He doesn't call it body knowledge, but he has an inverse kinematics character that he's layering human behavior stuff on top of. Highly recommend that. Jeff Lander wrote a bunch of articles in GD Mag about CCD, and his code is online, as I think the articles might be on Gamma Sutra. And again, come to the Experimental Gameplay Workshop and to check out people pushing the boundaries of experimental gameplay, including my game. And that's it. Thank you. I'm over time, so just come up and ask questions if you have questions. I think we should go. Thanks.